You are not to discuss this matter amongst yourselves.
We don't submit reports or ask approval for specific operations, if that's what you mean. We are an autonomous department.
Any questions?
Broadcasting from an abandoned subspace relay orbiting Risa, this is Section 31, gathering intelligence for you on Star Trek CCG. Now reporting in, operatives Dan and Rogue.
Welcome to Section 31, episode number 92. I'm Dan Hammond.
And I'm Rogue Schindler.
This week we have guest. The guest is Brad DeFruiter. Welcome in, Brad.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh, well, help me, Spock! The shields are down, the wormhole's caving in.
So, we're having you here because apparently you're making the podcast rounds.
Yeah, I think at ESPN they call it doing the car wash, where you go and you're on the first show in the morning, then you're the guest on the next show, then you're guest on the next show after that. Call it doing the car wash.
Yeah.
I'm doing the Star Trek car wash.
So now, are you going to Conan? I know his new show starts this week, so that could be your next stop.
If he's doing STCCG stuff, I think I'm on the list.
Well, go ahead.
I was just going to say, that sounds, why don't we dive in then? I know we kind of wanted to talk about just sort of things on a grand scale more than anything in particular. So thinking on a grand scale about the game always makes me think of the meta of the game and how it shifts and why it shifts and when it shifts. And I was just wondering if, what it is, if there is anything that makes you think that, is it time for a shift in the meta? Is there something that we see in games that needs to be changed? When do we change that, or do we let things go for a little while to make things interesting? I'm thinking about, big game-changing things. I'm thinking, four or five sets in, there was a whole planet and then space that seemed to be the way everybody goes, and then a handful of dilemmas came out, and all of a sudden it was like you better go space first and then planet. The whole shift away from to headquarters, the shift in dilemmas. I mean, is there anything that you look for in particular, or do you just kind of, is that a design thing that you look for as each set or as the game matures?
Yeah. there's some things that, of course, that I'll look for, any kind of triggers of something getting played a lot, or people are relying on a certain strategy repeatedly. Or a card or a card type being underplayed. Those are always things. But I also think there's just the, it's been long enough, let's start trying something else, scheme of things. Necessary Evil changed a lot, and I think that was a real point where I felt comfortable as a designer really putting things on its ear. I really think the game needs it. If you don't have that consistent changing of the meta that you're talking about, and it's even just changing the way you look at the game on a regular basis, our game will become stagnant, and I don't think we'll enjoy it as much. And you hear people talk about their standby deck a lot. Well, I don't know if it's good in the game that you have that standby deck, or it's probably really not good for the game if I don't have reasons to tweak my old standby. And I think that's another reason why I like to keep things changed up every so often and make things change.
Do you have like a grand plan looking off into the future about rolling this to the left a little bit and then to the right, and eventually we'll get to this area here, or you do just kind of change things up when you feel like it?
Yeah, I have the next 37 expansions planned out and laid out.
Sure.
No, I don't think I planned the things that too well. I think also because I with how what our release schedules look like, we have time to jump on changes right away that we want to make, and I think that's better than me laying too much down ahead and having too much of a grand theme. I think another thing is that we've hit a lot of the good guys affiliations already. There's not that hanging out there of, oh, when are they going to get to original series people, and when are they going to get to Starfleet? Well, we've hit that, so now I think expansions are all about kind of stabilizing the game, and you know, and then if things start to look stable, that's when we knock it over and try to change things up a little bit. But there's not like a real long term plan that I have set up for a second edition.
What do you think is the last time you really rocked the boat a lot? I mean, what was the previous big goal?
I think just this last peak performance did a nice rocking to the boat, just because some of the dilemmas alone. I think also adding more of the personnel control, it really changes things around a lot, you know.
When you went into that with that, you know, goal, how much of that is game theory and how much of that is just trying something new?
Oh, man, I'd love to say it's some sort of 50-50 split, but it's most likely it's a lot more of the, you know, what you're saying is game theory. It's really that we have to have some sort of specific goal, because if you just want to try something new or you just want to try something different, you end up with you can end up with goofy cards like personal force field and stuff like that. You know, you gotta have stuff that's got a plan. You know, that we need to change things around. Although I have to tell you that it makes design a little bit more boring, a little more stressful when you have to try to follow that plan instead of just going, well, this is a neat interaction that we have between these cards, or this is an interaction that makes for something really cool. There's less of that with smaller expansions and wanting to fill those gaps of this is planned. You know, each affiliation or sub-affiliation needs to have X, Y, Z in it. So that sometimes takes away some of the fun, but I still think there's plenty of fun making cards as it is. So.
Now, you spoke about dilemmas coming out in this most recent set. That was actually one of the shifts that I first noticed back when DS9 was a playable competitive affiliation, and the last really good deck that I could actually win with before Necessary Evil kind of turns everything on its ear. But the reason they were so strong was because they were so skill versatile. Because of the treachery folk and the confessions of the moonlight and the all of the skill passage, but the dilemmas shifted so much to the random stop, random stop, random stop, nothing you can do about it, random stop. And now it, you know, with this most recent set, it feels like we're coming back away from that again into the emphasis with the skill dilemmas. Is that a common theme where with the ebb and flow of a mechanic can go away and come back again?
Yeah, I think that it flowed too far in another direction to bring it back to using more skill dilemmas. I think hammers are needed instead of, you know, encouraging people to just go that way. You've almost got to force them to go that way. I'm not totally sold on doing a lot of skill dilemmas. I just want some more in the game, and I don't know if the direction that we're going right now is the right way, but I think that as long as people are enjoying the game, it is right. But I the jury's still out right now, and I'm not sure.
Well, and it certainly, I mean, it's not, I don't think there's anything that's going to suddenly demand that everybody play with skill dilemmas, but definitely wanting to at least pepper some in so they don't get getting hit with Dan's new favorite dilemma. What's it called?
What, Legacy?
Yeah, Legacy.
I put one in. What are you talking about?
Yeah, but it won you a tournament.
That it did.
But between I think
that just throwing that one in that dilemma pile is probably more genius than what we're seeing being talked about out there. And I think that made that dilemma pile that much more potent for that weekend. I think also it was a good meta choice, having a feeling that you were going to face certain decks the whole time. I thought it was great. When I heard it, I laughed really hard and was just like, that's great. He only used one. So,
well, if you use more than one, then one of them might come up when you play it.
Exactly.
You got to keep
right,
it simple.
Right, but then you may not get it at all during your mission steps.
That's
you
true.
Have to actually have those other dilemmas actually have to do something besides just come up off the top of the pile.
Yeah, between that and the semi-recent addition of like cards like Rega and Bridge Officer's Test, that kind of smashed the wall, as it were, of dropping one wall dilemma and stopping everybody. So definitely a big shift in dilemmas in the last couple of sets.
You know, I have to say that even during the design of Energize, that's expansion number two there. I really like the idea of someone just saying, oh, here's the one dilemma that you're not ready for, and here you go. Screw you. And I always thought that was a kind of neat idea, but as we've gone, there's enough of those dilemmas that are almost auto stops out there that we needed some cards like Bridge Officer's Test, and we needed some personnel that maybe had 2x leadership that can be used for more people, so that Bridge Officer's Test was more open to try to counter some of those things. But Machinations was set up with that whole idea of I've done some skill tracking maybe, or I've got a hunch that you don't have enough of this integrity that I can go fetch that one random dilemma that's going to stop you, and let me go grab it. Boom, here you go. I like that idea that there was a chess match going on there, that both players knew what was going on and what was going to happen.
Yeah, Machinations has always been one that I don't play well because I don't skill track well. I very heavily relied on things like Chul the Chandra and a minor revolt that just stops a bunch of people. That was always good for me because I didn't have to think very much. Do you skill track well?
I do, and maybe that's unfair that I think that skill tracking should be part of the game. But I mean, I tracked really good with Yuta numbers in first edition, I know it's funny to think about Yuta like that, but I had some players that would really get upset with me. I remember winning a tournament, and I mean, I had Yuta hit twice against this one guy who was really upset with it, and he mentioned afterwards, he's just like, it's dumb that you memorized a set of numbers and that's why you were doing so well. And, I had to let him know. I was just like, listen, I don't have these numbers memorized. I just watched for when you played a personnel that I was worried about, did the math really quick, and tried to keep it and tried to remember, the math for just that one game, And that was, that was kind of root skill tracking for me back then, is the same kind of thing I did later. And, I'd like to think I do now is I'm not tracking all the skills out there. I'm just watching how much archaeology you have out, or whatever the skill that's in vogue at that time is.
Yes. Well, Brad, there was a discussion that you and I had a while ago on one of the boards. I think we were discussing prizes, and I brought up a card, and you had a negative reaction to it. I was wondering if you could share your thoughts on an issue of trust and why you have such a visceral reaction to this card.
An issue of trust. Let me give you a little background here, too. An issue
Please.
Of trust was when it was the titles and lore was being put on Issue of Trust, and that expansion, which was Captain Slog, was being put together is right when I came back from my hiatus from Decipher. And I was asked to do titles and lore, and I need a, you know, there was a need for a couple extra cards, and then ironing out the wording on Voyager cards. So I had the chance to change an Issue of Trust. And there were a few other cards in Captain's Log that I had a chance to change. But I had early on in design had someone come in late to a process and demand a bunch of cards get changed. Even though I tested them, they seemed like they were working well, and it left a bad bad taste in my mouth. So I didn't try to put down any kind of talk about changes that needed to happen on cards. And that's one reason why I have that kind of quantum leap talk that I had with Charlie. But it's that idea that, man, if I can go back to change, you know, a few cards here and there, that would be one of them. An Issue of Trust has a couple issues with it. One, all of those blended style dilemmas are severely under-costed. And I say blended style, and I know that immediately we think, well, blended was good in first edition, but not second edition. And the reason why it may not be as good in second edition is because one of the two skills that it filters is telepathy, which I don't know about you guys, but not all my opponents come with telepathy, you know, or packing personnel with telepathy.
Yeah, not so much.
And I think that, yeah, not so much, right, yeah. So I think that that's one of the things going on there is that, what is it, personal duty? That's a blended dilemma that lots of people use. Yeah. I mean, a real lot of people use.
Very and the classic big reason mainstream. Why.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost a stock dilemma that you talk about. We even reprinted it. It's that much of a stock dilemma. We reprinted it as a you know, a printable card now with the 15th anniversary collection that it was part of. And the reason it works so good is because it hits leadership and officer, something that you're going to see a lot. Well, you're going to see a lot of honor and treachery too. But on top of that, so it's under cost. I feel like all those dilemmas are under costed. Now, the hypocrite in me is going to come out and probably say, I'll make another dilemma like this, and it's going to have probably similar cost. But to hit those type of skills is doubly difficult. So my first point is it's awfully under costed. The second is those skills that it hits are very difficult because we want everybody to play the mains, right? We want to play the people that they see in the show or the people they recognize or the people that make me want to play Star Trek instead of going playing some other game, you know? And coincidentally, those people tend to be good guys or bad guys. And good guys or bad guys tend to have honor or treachery. And we kind of set up the situation where this is a dilemma that says don't play with unique personnel. But everything else in the game says unique personnel are cool, play with unique personnel. So suddenly we have this dilemma that's really good against a lot of decks because there's so many reasons to play with unique personnel. And honor and treachery really hurt them. And it's especially the treachery because we've got some treachery affiliations out there. And they hurt out there because they hit an issue of trust a lot. So those are my gameplay reasons why I don't really like Issue of Trust. It hits some affiliations that don't need to be hit hard, and it's very under-costed. My other reason that's maybe more of the knee-jerk reason is that during playtesting, I can make a strong personnel, and a comment about it, that personnel would be, well, you know, he's got treachery, so he gets hit by an issue of trust, so I'm not that worried about him. It just makes me want to yell, you know? So, and especially the honor and treachery are often dictated by a personnel's integrity, which can be dictated by the story of that character. You know, if a character has a low enough integrity, they have to have treachery. If they have high enough integrity, they have to have honor. And a lot of times that honor and treachery is determined by story and not necessarily by we want this person all to have those skills. Ta-da!
I think when I suggested that be a new promo card, let me see if I can pull up the exact quote here. You said, "I hate this card. I would rather ban it along with some other things, and burn all known copies, and then take those ashes and lock them in a vault at the bottom of the deepest trench in the ocean, and erase all memory of those cards, then reprint them."
I have a short list of cards I'd like to do that with.
Yes, yes, I wrote those words.
That's awesome.
actually, I should say those words were written by me, right? If I want to try to paraphrase.
Yes, the book, right? There you go.
Written by me. Yes. And there was a few other cards that got that went in that little tirade, but an issue of trust is one of them. You know, when I created a couple personnel that were issue of trust busters, my only problem was that I put one of them in Klingon when I really should have put it in Romulan, and which Romulan has with Narelle, but
Narelle.
Wow. See, you guys have the same pronunciation of it.
Probably because we're playing the same playgroup.
Oh, yeah, right. Well, hey, you know, there's a I think the pronunciation thing is kind of funny sometimes because what's the Darmok and Jalad, pronounce the name of the non-aligned character that's trapped on the planet with Picard?
Dathan? Or is it
Dathan?
Exactly. It's Dathan to me, you know? So I've heard the Dathan, and I've always been like, what is this? What's going on? Yeah. Anyway, I put Narelle in Romulan, and I probably shouldn't have made the Klingon version. I probably should have put that in a different affiliation. So I don't know, I guess live and learn, right?
So I've got a question about another card that I've always wanted to try to use, and it's never really worked for me at all. It was all the way back in Premiere, and it was it was to boldly go this Federation. If you had to play it, you have to have already completed a planet in space. It costs 3, and you can destroy it to prevent your Fed people who are about to be stopped by a dilemma from being stopped. What? I love this picture. I love the idea, but I just haven't been able to actually use it for anything.
I've got a couple stories about boldly go. Yes, I do. When we were doing some of the, and when I say we, I mean Evan and I. Evan Lorenz and I were laying down some of the principles that we were thinking about for the game. One thing that we talked about was that Federation would not have a round the corner card, and a round the corner card is a way to get the last 30-35 points that you need to win a game. So, you know, you can do 2 missions and then fight for the last 30 points, you know, with Ba or what's the Doran card, just like old times card, you know, that you could, those were round the corner cards, get you around the corner and get you to the victory. We said Federation wouldn't have round the corner, but this was their round the corner card. The idea was that I do 2 missions and then I use to boldly go to try to help me force my way through that last mission easier. Obviously your frustration with it is not an isolated event, and it probably could have had another way to there probably should have been another way for that to work that would have been a little bit smoother, because it only works on one dilemma. it costs 3, which is somewhat standard for around the corner card, but the fact that it only works on one dilemma and it has to be stopped personnel, then it gets destroyed. It probably shouldn't have been destroyed. It probably should have had a limit to say that you can only do it once per turn. But yeah, there's some failings and frustrations with that, and it's I also think, you know, if this costed 1 or 2, it might be a little more acceptable to have 3 of those stacked up and ready to go at your last mission to get you around the corner. So, do you think that concurs with some of your frustration with this card?
That and I find that it's the timing of when you can play it is difficult because you have to hold it in your hand until you've solved your other 2 missions.
Yeah, I think late game mid game to late game cards like that are difficult to play, and they need to probably have a bigger cookie reward at the end. Artifacts are a great example of that. Think of some artifacts that are in the game that you're not going to play with them. You know, hey, they look neat, but I'm probably not going to use them because the reward isn't big enough. You know, it's obviously, the Sword of Kaelas is a great example of an artifact that works well. Of course, now you're going to make me go look at other artifacts to give examples of ones that I don't think are that good. You know, that don't give. And I keep on thinking about the glowy Ferengi ball, but I actually think there are a decent amount of people that like to use
Thought Maker
those,
is really so. Useful.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it pops into my head, but I know that people are using Thought Maker, so that's obviously an awful example. And then I talked about Resican Flute, but I think some people do use Resican Flute, but I don't know if it's obviously Resican Flute should probably be an artifact. It fits really well. That gameplay maybe doesn't fit the gameplay of a card that gets played in mid to late game. I guess I'm not going to have a lot of those events in my discard pile in the early game. So maybe it's a good example, but it doesn't give me that, you know, I don't feel like it's a huge reward. Although there's not a lot of discard retrieval for events out there, so. And I know that I ran into a deck build once that was getting back the Maquis bouncy event repeatedly with Resican Flute. What's the man? I'm drawing a blank on card names today.
Stalling for time.
Stalling for time. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That's an interesting.
Apparently,
the whole artifact mechanic that you're talking about, as far as playing, you know, the difficulty of playing game, having to hold cards and wait to play them late game, because that in particular, I don't think I've ever seen. You know, aside from when they first came out and people were trying them out, almost all of the artifact wielding decks I've seen are always have some method of playing them without having to wait around. Usually because of Baran, but I think because you in 1E, you know, you put them under a mission, you knew they were there, and you knew that when you solved that mission, you were going to get it. Whereas in 2E, you still have to solve a mission, but then you still have to play it. You have to wait to draw it and play it. So you are either sitting there holding it in your hand, waiting until you solve a mission to play it, or you solve your mission and you're digging and digging and digging to find it. It was a not ideal. I think that's something that people went.
Yeah.
I think that's why the artifacts, because they're worth playing. It's the timing of getting to play them.
Yeah, and even how or just the opposite, how we even got on the subject is the same thing. Is that this will be a card that sits in my hand, you know, while I'm, you know, it's in my opening hand. I'm just like, great, this is just going to sit in my opening hand, you know, because unless I have a way to filter it back into my deck, and even then, I don't know when I'm going to draw it again, so maybe I'm glad I drew it, but it's not helping me, I don't know. So I think I definitely think there's a place in the game for cards that are played mid to late game. I just think that they can be frustrating to play with. So to avoid that frustration, I think one of two things needs to happen. That card needs to come with some sort of dual ability, which wouldn't work on an artifact, but maybe for To Boldly Go is another example of this, is that maybe To Boldly Go needed to have some other ability that it would make you play it early or make you cycle it out of your hand or something like that, you know, a lesser ability, and then it had a big cookie on it if you were actually working on a later mission or something. Obviously, I don't think that would work with To Boldly Go, but maybe a card like that with its a mid to late game, it should have a an early game use, you know, and then maybe a late game use as well. You know, let me talk about what else I don't like about To Boldly Go. It's the lore on To Boldly Go. It's outrageously frustrating because if you read this lore, you realize very quick, this is Zefram Cochrane's speech from the first episode of Enterprise, which, well, I guess if you don't watch Enterprise, you didn't realize this. But what made this frustrating was when, first of all, it's more than just a sentence there. It's a couple sentences there that encompass some really strong Star Trek lore words. So when we went to go make Enterprise cards based off Enterprise, if we wanted to do anything from that quote, we constantly, it was just like, hey, that's on To Boldly Go. You can't use that. You got to use something else instead. And that's frustrating. That's also why I'm not a fan of alternate image cards using new lore.
Because it takes away
it's less lore you can use in the future.
Exactly, and it will force me to actually write lore, and I am not good at writing lore at all. Not good at all. In fact, sometimes when I'm pressed to write lore, I'll try to go find the 1E counterpart of the card, and I'll copy that lore onto the second edition card. You know, maybe I have to do an adjustment, but like if someone calls me out on it, I can always go, "Oh, it's a throwback." I'm just acknowledging the older card.
That lore
but
makes
really,
me...
But really, I'm just being lazy.
Well, that lore cracks me up, too, because there was a space in there where it was like Captain's Log and These Are the Voyages and Dangerous Missions, Continuing Missions, and we're like, you know, how many sets are going to come out before they have that entire opening sequence? You can just line up the sets and do the whole thing. You know, you could have space and just be a bunch of 1E missions. Or Space the Final Frontier and do a whole bunch of missions. I really liked the idea of the voyages of the Starship Enterprise and make it like a boutique 20-card set, and it's just all different new Enterprises from all different shows.
Guys, don't say anything like that around Charlie, because he'll want to make a boutique product that has nothing but Enterprise in it.
Yes.
And every card has to say Enterprise on it. He will. In fact, if you guys hear like a hail sound in the background, that's my phone beeping that he just sent me an email about that.
Yeah. You can make it.
Wow, you got that aircraft carrier.
Yeah, they don't even have to be all ships. You can be like the event Enterprise J. You could do an aircraft carrier Enterprise on an event somehow.
It could be dilemmas that just mention the Enterprise. Yeah. guys, Charlie loves Enterprises, which is good. You know, there are lots of players do. I think we should have more Enterprises in the game, but don't talk about radical things like that, because it'll happen. It'll happen.
A sailing ship from Generations.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great.
Some kind of event that
That'd
promotes
be a great
somebody.
Dilemma, don't you think? Oh, you think an event that outs someone. Oh, I was thinking like it's a dilemma that you got to.
Oh, yeah, that works too.
You get Worf walking the plank or something?
Exactly. Well, or just the idea that you had to get dressed up in those awful costumes to get on the boat.
Unless you have this many command stars, all of your staff stars are stopped.
Yes, all right. I got a question, actually. During the time...
Oh, questions are good, yeah.
during the time of Enterprise, when that set was being kind of thrown out, in the very, very beginnings, were you around for that?
For To Boldly Go? I had nothing to do with To Boldly Go. I was completely gone.
Really?
My hiatus started the day I finished all work on Strange New Worlds. I finished it all on a Friday, and then Monday morning I came into work and was told that I didn't need to come into work anymore. So, which I thought was an awful coincidence. And then I came back when the lore was being put on the cards for Captain's Log and Genesis.
Were you around for the decision to not make Starfleet kind of a Federation faction? Was that decided when you were still around?
It might have been. I think that there were definitely some notes and because Evan and I like to plan ahead on stuff. You can't believe how many times that a game idea was put up that someone said, "Oh, that sounds really Ferengi. We should put that aside." You know, and it could have been some awesome gameplay, and someone would have been like, "Oh, that sounds very Ferengi. You'll have to put that aside." Even Decay. When Decay came out, we're like, "This is a great way we can do some sort of countdown mechanic or something." And someone was just like, "You know, that's almost like Ferengi stockpiling." We had to really think about it, and we had to work Decay around so it didn't seem like it was too Ferengi, you know, which is crazy. But definitely, that was part of the plan. I think Starfleet to be their own affiliation. I think that may have actually even came out before the very first expansion was made. There was talk that Starfleet would be their own, just as well as that Voyager would not have a headquarters mission. I think both of those were decided very early. I think that my big regret with Starfleet is the Icon, because I think right after we had settled with the Icon is when what's very similar to the 22nd century Icon for first edition started showing up all over the show. And it was just like, damn, if you guys had just put that Icon on 3 episodes earlier, we could have changed it all. So, but
kind of the sideways triangular Federation logo.
Delta thing, yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, but I'm not alone with that, because I'll tell you something that I had heard that first edition designers talk about that struck me as interesting was – you know how in first edition when you made a personnel, that the card tried to encompass all of the personnel. So if that person at one time had played a flute, he got music. Mm-hmm. You know, and it really tried to jam it all onto that one person and make them that iconic, this is Data, you know, and everything about it. Well, I remember first edition designers being really upset the moment Sisko started playing a piano. Because the Sisko card was already made for Deep Space Nine. It was a later season when he shows up in the Creole Cafe playing the piano.
Yeah.
And I just remember hearing one of them just like, "Ah, I wish I'd known, because we would have given Sisko music." You know, and it's such an odd skill too. It was, and there was such regret in his voice too. He was so bummed that Sisko card didn't have music, you know. Which I guess is another great difference between the first edition thought then and what second edition thought was. I mean, from the first expansion on, was we're going to try to give a slice of the character, and that way we can do multiple characters, you know.
Yeah, because we learned that. There were two Picards and so forth in the first set alone, right?
Yeah, exactly. Two Siskos right off the bat. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah,
then
maybe only one of
a couple of Rikers, a couple of Worfs. You know, it was nice to have a variety and get that flavor for whatever particular version you're going for.
Right, exactly. So you know, anyway, I guess I'm just trying to say there was a big difference between first edition and second edition thought processes, but I think that might be obvious to a lot of us now.
Well, Brad, we've asked you a lot of questions, and rumor has it you have a questions for us.
If we look back through the expansions that have been done for the continuing committee, there's been some committee. There's been some mechanics that have shown up, you know, repeatedly. In in Undiscovered Country, we had some putting cards underneath the deck, some interrupt love, some playing from behind cards that helped you play from behind. Favor of the Bold touched on a whole bunch of dilemmas and dilemma interaction, as well as some of the anti, you don't have a skill dilemma. Raise the Stakes had a lot of going big and being big. All females, teams. If in a future expansion you guys could have me make something that was going to repeat one of those mechanics, what would you guys like? Either because it was undeveloped, or because you really liked it and you want to see more of it. What would you guys like to see?
I like the idea. There was a cycle. Is that the right word? Of dilemmas.
Sure.
That keyed off of keywords your opponent had, like skeptical spirit.
I liked the idea of those a lot.
Yeah, I haven't honestly. I think I've tried the Jem'Hadar one, but that's the only one I've really been able to get to work. Which one is that? Savagery to match their numbers.
Yeah, nice.
Yes.
Rings
with the alphas.
Reference.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, no, great reference, because it fits so well.
Yes.
Great reference.
Yes, perfect.
I love that one.
Yeah, I agree. I would like to see that maybe a little more potent. I guess I felt like, I definitely felt like the general reception was, you know, to have so specific a key that they didn't really do much, or they were hard to get to work.
Yeah, I like the linking of the dilemma pile to the deck in that way, so that
yes,
the more I get out, the later in the game, the stronger these get. That's kind of cool, but didn't I do not feel as if they were cards that I want to play with.
Sure, I think I may have erred too much on the side of safety with those cards. So, is it the linking of what's in your deck with your dilemma pile that's more appealing to it, or is it the idea that if I get more of something out, my dilemmas are more potent? I guess those go hand in hand, kind of.
Yeah.
Which is more important? Which is more important? Do you think guys think?
I know that for the most part, I have a dilemma pile, and maybe I'll add in a couple, some of a specific card, like Reflections, if I'm playing an AU deck, or I'll take them out if I'm not,
yeah.
Or I'll put in a couple of other things to match a deck. But for the most part, and I'm probably, you know, not typical, but I only have pretty much that one dilemma pile that I play with a lot of different decks. There's not a lot of going back and forth. Every once in a while, change it out, do something radical. But I end up usually coming back to it because it works well for me. But
Rogue, are you the same way?
I am the same way. Unless I have a specific goal in mind, like I'm playing a capture deck that I want a lot of support for, or sometimes I will take out, you know, a dozen filters and I'll swap in the 40 point mission dilemmas if I'm playing with some 40 pointers because those are useful. But in general,
excellent.
I have a set dilemma pile that I occasionally modify, depending on the deck, but it's usually maybe one out of three outings that I do that.
Okay. Well, let me just say, you guys are very bad for the game.
Yeah. on many levels.
I, Right, exactly. I think that's probably common out there that type of thing goes on. So,
well, and I'll tell you why, the guys like who are not you, who are not good at skill tracking, and you know have to, or you know at least have a very low level of skill tracking, and need to have something consistent that they can at least have half a chance at. That establishes a sort of a standard that we can play with and at least, you know, be semi consistent. Unlike, you know, the
sure.
the overwhelm decks or the I know Thomas Weinberg can count skills like there's no tomorrow, and he'll drop dilemmas that you don't see anywhere else in the state. And we're like, what? But that's a horrible dilemma. People always have those skills. I mean, you know, he's like, yeah, but you don't right now. What? Sure I do. Oh, no. No.
No, I don't. No, that's great. I love that. I love that. Well, okay. No, that was my big question there. I mean, obviously, you guys aren't looking for the Gorgon type of interaction or the Furfursis bluff kind of dilemma where it's just like I just pitch raw cards that maybe don't have that much of an interaction with my dilemma pile.
Yeah, you know, you're right. I think I have played a tactical disadvantage and Gorgon deck with like a Dominion deck or a Borg deck. That kind of thing goes hand in hand, goes well. But I think the more things that make me want to change my dilemma pile from deck to deck, the better. It'll make me think more.
Yeah.
Okay. That really answers the question, guys. I have another question for you guys here. Now, this question is, I love it. I get to ask the question. this one is a little bit interesting. Think about some cards like at what cost that you have to lose points in order to play the card. Do you guys ever worry about playing those cards knowing that they can be prevented and you still lose the points? Or a card that has a very high cost, like a no-win situation. Are you worried about? Do you guys hesitate to use cards like that, knowing that the cost is going to be is high, or do you guys look at more of what the end result is going to be?
I don't think that prevents me from using something. I think usually if I'm going to be using a card like that, I go into it knowing that I'm going to have to pay the cost for it, and you know, especially something like At What Cost is a popular card to be canceled if you can, and you know, you just have to be aware that when you're doing the math, that's you know, those are points that you're not going to get back, and make sure that it's not going to put you into a you know a 95 point situation where you're going to have to do another mission to get the win off.
Rogue, did you recently have a "You've Always Been My Favorite" canceled?
You know what? Not only did I not have it canceled, I had two of them out, and then had them put back under my deck.
Ah.
They were not canceled. They were sent back.
Oh.
Because I played the one.
Oh, ow.
Yeah, I played the one, and I took a couple cards off, and I was like, well, he hasn't canceled it yet, and I really want to get this going and so I can draw the cards. So I played two of them, and I drew about three cards off of each, and so they both still had two cards on them. And he sent them back under my deck, and all those cards went away. So that was... I basically got one card's worth out of the two of them.
That is so sad. That is an awful story. I mean, that's depressing. And you still play the game?
Yeah, well, that was that actually was not the worst setback, if you can believe it.
Really? What happened to you later on that was a worse setback than that?
I got everything set up anyway, I was all set, and then my next move was to quintess for my ship, and he canceled my quintessence, and then peeled two ships off the top of my deck with Prejudice and Politics, after making me discard the two that were in my hand with some other Romulan shenanigans. So I went through four of my ships without getting to play any of them in a matter of a turn and a half. So I basically spent the rest of the turn sitting there watching him play.
This is what you get for opposing the Romulan Empire.
Yes, clearly the Borg did not know who they had come to assimilate. And they paid the price. or as I said to him at the time, you know what? I changed my mind. You're not my favorite.
I love stories like that, guys, and I love listening to your show just for you guys telling stories of things that happened at tournaments, because it happens all the time. Everybody's got a story when they leave the tournaments, and it's great to get those stories and hear those stories, because it makes playing exciting, you know, and to know that these things can happen. So I love it. I love stories like that.
Well, good. That's good to hear. We come in and do this on a mostly weekly basis, and sometimes wonder if we're just listening to ourselves talk. So it's good to hear that somebody out there, you and those other two people, enjoy listening to tales of the San Diego tournaments.
So, you know, when you guys spoil the episode, I don't want to sound like I'm an obsessive fan of your guys' show or anything, but the episode in which you spoiled Sent Back, which we were just talking about, you guys also talked a little bit about the flavor of the card, and I thought I might talk about that a little bit. I love that someone can see gameplay and say, oh, that's Federation. Oh, that's a Maquis type of gameplay. Or, oh, that goes into Romulan. But I think that being strict like that may be not good for the game. English is a strong point of mine. I think some mechanics overlapping between affiliations is actually good, and I get it with Maquis a lot. There's always cards that will show up that I hear people say, "Wow, that seems kind of Maquis-ish." Well, that seems Maquis-ish, and I think that, one, that says a lot about the Maquis, that they have these signature moves that people really recognize, which is good, but I think that it maybe is a little bit narrow, that people don't realize that it's probably good and it's healthy for the game that there is some of this overlap that exists between different affiliations. And I think that it's good that we have some of that stuff. So I don't want – what we want to say here is, I hope people aren't as disappointed when they see a mechanic and they say, really, that should be TNG, you know, or that sounds really Voyager to me, and it's on a Deep Space Nine card. I don't really like that. So I hope that people maybe can be a little more tolerant sometimes of us having a little bit of that I don't want to call it a bleed, because that's almost like a bad buzzword, but of that sharing of some of the mechanical pies that exist in the game.
Well, particularly for Romulan and Maquis, there's so much manipulation going on both sides that those are both signature flavors for those affiliations, not just in the card game, but, you know, in the Trek verse. So it can be hard to look at something that is manipulative and say, well, is that a Romulan manipulative, or is that a Maquis manipulative? So I don't know that's necessarily a good point. As far as flavor bleed, you know, if there's something, I actually like the idea, you know, you think of like Magic when they did, you know, sort of reddish flavor cards in the blue or the red or the black or whatever. You know, if it fits with a, for like for instance, the Deep Space Nine treachery strain, you know, those were, that was a thing that was like, whoa, Deep Space Nine should have treachery though, you know, that was a sort of subculture in that set that had a particular set of skills that, you know, or flavor that could have happened somewhere else. I think that's cool.
I agree
to have that little splash.
Yeah, some of Right, like the redirection that moved from blue to red in Magic. It's maybe that same idea is. No, that's good to think that. I'll give you an example of how we've rethought some of those things. One of them is that it's a Federation thing for them to want to share, or for them to have everybody do something. But I think there's been so many key cards that have fallen into the next generation that when we see it in another Federation faction, we get the that's more TNG than Deep Space Nine. And we've recently had Voyager be like they're super good at it, you know, that they share really big things, you know, is something that they do. And I think that there was still that feeling of, no, that should be a Next Generation thing. That shouldn't be a Voyager thing. When it's really, it was just a Federation thing. But for one, designers did a poor job of not spreading it around, apparently. And that when they did make it, it was like a really good card in for Next Generation is probably what reasons why it those feelings existed. Common ground, that's what I'm thinking of. The common ground type of card.
Oh,
you see that common ground. If I were to make a card tomorrow that said, oh, and this is going to lead to something else I wanted to ask you guys, that said each player downloads a personnel that costs 4 or more and places them on a headquarters event that could be played. If I made that so everybody could have it, do you think that I've tread it on Federation territory or even Next Generation's territory?
I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is that does sound like it's a very TNG feel, but I think it's all in how it's presented. I mean, certainly you could call it, you know, something like Diplomatic Conference or you know, somewhere where
Iron Mercenaries or something.
Yeah,
like that.
If it was something where, you know, it makes sense from a story or a lore flavor point of view for both players to have a couple of, you know, secret rendezvous where a couple of, you know, characters show up together, then sure.
Yeah, we can be very easily influenced by, you know, fancy words in the title and lore.
Presentation!
You guys are right. Presentations is good. A great example of that is The Circle, which was in These Are the Voyages.
Yeah.
And that's the event that says, you know, when you command Bajor, no other... when an opponent has 7 or more personnel in their discard pile, you can spend extra counters. And I remember that during playtesting of this, I constantly got people saying, this isn't Bajoran. This sounds more Klingon. I mean, my Bajorans aren't out there killing people. This doesn't sound right, you know. But the moment that the Circle story got laid on top of it, no one said anything else. It all made sense.
Exactly. It's that subculture within the Bajorans that makes it make sense.
What I was leading to with the other question there was the last time that I was on the show, and I think another time that I may have had a conversation with you guys, maybe it was for the show as well, was a question you guys had, and I think it only aired once, was you asked me if I thought the game was too slow, and that and obviously I have to assume that this came from games going to time. Do you guys still feel that the game feels like it's going too slow?
I actually kind of thought of this when we were talking about the meta discussion earlier, because of the way the I think there's been a slight downturn, certainly in our meta, a slight downturn in the heavy dilemma manipulation play, and between that and the upturn of cards like Bridge Officer's Test, which I think is in, you know, 80% of the decks out here, and Rega and Kirk, you know, things that can blow through the heavy dilemmas even if you have, you know, a bunch of machinations and can keep piling on dilemma after dilemma after dilemma long after you've had enough people to overcome the number of dilemmas are there. that bypass has sort of sped things up a little bit. At least I feel like that's where it's been leaning. What do you think, Dan?
You know, it's interesting because we'll have an event where someone will bring a deck that just isn't fast, and it'll feel like the whole tournament just comes to a grinding halt. And then there'll be some weeks when, you know, TK plays something fast and he's done in 25 minutes every time, win or lose.
Yeah.
And those tournaments seem to fly by. So I was looking for some results from our last event just to see what had happened, but I was, you know, it's kind of all over the place.
I mean,
I don't feel like the last one Eve tournament where it was like the third round before we had a game finish.
Yeah. Well, and that was not entirely Oney's fault. I think that was, you know, almost every deck that was there had mission overlap, which immediately makes the game last yeah. longer. But our last 2E event, I don't know, I was playing a pretty slow deck, and I still felt like things were moving along pretty well, with the exception of the slog, hot Borg-on-Borg slog action, where we didn't leave our headquarters until... Neither of us left our headquarters until, like, 5 minutes left in the game.
Where yeah, you just sat there and stood at each other, stared
like,
at each other.
I'm not going anywhere until you leave. I was staring him down, basically, because I knew he was trying to wait me out, waiting for me to go do something and give up on you know, reacting. And I was like, I'm not going to let him outwait me. I'm not going to let him outwait me.
Okay, well, that was a big one for me there, guys. Just because I think that there's been some efforts to make sure that the game, I mean, games are obviously going to go to time no matter what. It's just part of the game, and that's why we do have the time limits. It's because yeah. those things will happen. But I think we've been trying to do some subtle things here and there to try to make sure that that gets minimized as much as possible. I shouldn't say as much as possible. We've done some things to minimize that. And obviously we're going to do some things to slow down the game in the future too. But hopefully the trade-offs happen and
bring things to a reasonable level.
A lot of complaints. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, like you said, you got to keep things moving. Otherwise it'll get a little stale. And if I had the chance, I'd do it all again and take a green bitch for my wife. Yeah, I was getting fat and I'm feeling old and my hair was
So, what do you guys think of Harry Mudd?
So far, I think it's interesting. I'm curious to see where we're going to go with it.
Yeah, it's tough because, like we were talking about earlier, personnel in 1E are a lot different than personnel in 2E, and it's easy to make a 1E personnel that just got a few skills and, you know, fits with the character, whereas 2E, you know, you can give them an ability that can do just about anything. There's plenty of room. You know, the sky's the limit.
I definitely like the idea of having a crime/thief enhancing card for him to come in and help that sort of sub-deck.
So how disrupting is the will of the collective toward design just in general?
Not really that much. I think I've got so much that I need to worry about that I don't worry about will of the collective. I think that where it really starts to disrupt things is when we're playtesting the card. And we're playtesting it in the expansion that it's going to be released in. And so the collective has decided on the card, and it's weeks, maybe months down the road that it's getting tested, and we find a problem with it. And I think this may have been something that was going on with the headset. Not that the big problem with the headset during testing was, and I'm being very general here because obviously our playtesters look at lots of little things, but there was a little bit of a feeling that it should have been an event instead of an equipment. Equipment should really deal with people that are present with them, you know, and I don't know if the headset really did that well. And I think it was too difficult at that point for me to go back and say, all right, we started out saying we're doing an equipment for Will the Collective 2, and now it looks like it's not working as an equipment. Can we start over? You know, I can't ask, I don't want to ask the Collective to start over, because as part of the Collective, I don't want to go through it all over again. And two, as a designer, man, when you work on something for a while and then it just doesn't work and you got to drop it or you got to restart it, it's disappointing. And I'd hate to throw that on the whole community. Now, I know that the headset's been recently received some errata. I'll say that none of that errata happened because of the headset itself. I don't think the headset's a bad card, and I think it's fine as an equipment. But if something happens with Harry Mudd here or his ability, you know, maybe I have to tweak something that limits it once per turn. There's this feeling of, well, I've got to go back to the Collective and tell them what the issue is. And then the Collective needs to talk about what they think is a better fix. And then maybe they even need to vote on it. Well, by the time they do that, I'm several iterations of that expansion later. Do I just set the Collective card off to the side? So, I mean, I haven't had to come up with this, but I worry that may be something that's going to happen, that, you know, Harry Mudd's going to have an ability that's not going to work, or a playtest team's going to find some awful broken combination out there with it, and it's going to be backbreaking to have to go back and say, all right, I know you guys finished this, you know, a month ago, but here's the problems with it.
And then, do you think that the group, the Collective, is self-policing enough to try to I would imagine more people are looking at the card and voting than potentially there are playtesters. Do you think that's something they would catch before it goes off to playtesting?
Man, I sure hope so. I think that's the whole idea.
Is that something?
No, I think that's the whole idea. As many eyes on it as possible.
Yeah.
That get to say, you know, that really doesn't work with, I'm going to pull a random card up here and you guys are going to laugh because of how Harry Mudd's going to work with that. That really doesn't work with Changed History. Okay, that was a bad but you know what I'm saying? That they're going to find some awful combination of, you know, I know a way. Oh, Harry Mudd and Savick are just broken together. How? What? You know, that hopefully that the Collective finds that beforehand.
Has there been any?
But I think what happened.
Consideration?
No, there's been no consideration at all ever.
Oh, man.
No, I'm sorry, go ahead. What was the question?
No, I was just going to say, to alleviate that, has there been any thought to, you know, have a, you know, a round, a postseason round of Will the Collective, you know, if there is such an occurrence, look, you know, just come back from playtesting and say, look, guys, here's the problem. We can solve it A, B, or C, and, you know, and make it more balanced that way, and then have it vote. Have that be a collective vote?
No, I think that's a great plan. The only problem that fails with that plan is that it may push, because whatever we decide to change the card to, and I say we because I am part of the Collective as well, needs to be tested again. And it may push it too late in development that I'll feel it doesn't get enough testing and it needs to be pushed to the next expansion after that, which means another 4 months. You know, you thought you were going to see it in a couple months, but guess what? You're not going to see it for 6 months because I'm going to push it back again. And then we're going to have to bring up another vote for it. But I don't think – I really – this is a concern of mine, but I'll tell you, I don't think it's necessarily going to happen because – my big thing is I think that the Collective, you said self-policing, and I think that may be the wrong way of looking at it. I think that the Collective will wrap it up in Nerf way too quicker than I would. I might want to be more edgy with the card and go to testing while the collective might find ways to make it more balanced even before it reaches me and it reaches testing. So I think that's how it's going to be. But I think that giving options instead of necessarily asking the collective, how do you solve this problem, would be easier, and we'd get the card back into testing and maybe on schedule to show up in a reasonable amount of time. But I don't know. As members of the collective, do you want me coming and giving you, here's your three choices, or would you rather you guys offer up solutions instead?
Well, the tradition is a round of suggestions and then a round of voting on that, but that would be, you know, weeks.
Yeah, that really pushes it out, definitely, with the schedule.
I guess if I had to choose between choose one of these three options or it's going to be another 4 months before you actually see the card, I might choose the give me some options because you know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And a lot of times...
Well, I'm glad you guys have faith in me that I know what I'm talking about.
I think the collective... I mean, we saw a lot of this in the challenge, and I've already forgotten the captain's... Who's he? What's it?
Make it so.
Make it so. Challenge in that I think the collective who does not previously have that sort of experience, they're going to immediately try to go for a finished card. And that's what the collective is, to create a finished card, as opposed to like the design process where you come up with something edgy and you test it out and you know see how far you can push the limits before you pull it back and have an interesting card. So it might be more interesting to get that kind of feedback from the designer and say, well, okay, we can push it one of these three ways, or we can fix it one of these three ways. And you know, it'll still have the flavor that the collective has decided on, and they will get to choose, you know, which one of those to go. Yeah, I think that would probably be preferable to me versus going through a whole design process of voting for another 4 months.
Yeah, well, and guys, I think that there may be, we may have decided long ago what we would do if that came about, but I can't remember what the decision was. So there may already, like, I could so hear, like, you know, Matt or someone's going to listen to this and go, hey, we decided already what we would do if that happens. Why are you guys even talking about this? What is Brad doing? It's just because I'm old and I can't remember things like I used to. Obviously, sure. I can't remember card titles.
Card titles. Well,
like that card that did the bouncy thing. Yeah, that was great.
Yeah. I just wanted to ask you, as we were talking about the VR headset, that made me think of a question. You mentioned the. I'm pretty sure the collective, if I recall correctly, chose for the headset to be an equipment because it felt like something that needed to not be easily canceled, like an event would be. I'm assuming you gotta encounter that in the design process, where you feel like you have a concept that needs to have one set of mechanics, but on the other hand, needs to fit a different set for story, like the headset, something that felt like it should have been an event, but because of some kind of restriction, they wanted it to be a different card type. How do you reconcile that in the design process?
Darts. I put them all on the wall and throw darts up. No, there's sometimes that stuff really works itself out really easy. I do stress about little things like that, but there's give and take and push and pull on all sorts of things like that, and sometimes there's compromise. And I know that when the story is the compromise, some people don't like it, but that's the way it happens. Is that I think that there's enough push and pull and ways to go in different directions that we'll always be able to take care of some of that. And I think that in the end, if there'll be a compromise where someone says, that gameplay doesn't actually match up with the story that well. I think we've seen enough of it that we're kind of over it, and we can move past it.
All right. Well, that certainly makes sense.
You know, and I want to say that I think the headset we voted that it would be an artifact before we'd voted on anything else, and that we just like the idea that it was an artifact, so it couldn't be canceled or whatnot. Maybe I'm misremembering. I think that I think that's the PC term for I'm a dumbass and I've got it all wrong. I misremembered it.
Well, there's plenty to have to remember, so I'm sure you've got,
well, you know,
37 more sets to have, yeah, to remember, sure, than the rest of us. So I'm sure we can forgive you.
I used the wrong number too. I should have used 47
because that's, exactly,
the
track,
right? Yeah. See, I'm failing right and left with you guys. You know, something about the headset that you guys brought up that's interesting is the idea that maybe it was better as equipment so that it wouldn't get canceled out. And there's always times where make events that people, it gets dismissed right away because, oh, this event can be canceled. I think it's absolutely hilarious when that happens, and then another event comes out and people talk about, oh, it's too strong. But they stop talking about the ability to cancel this thing suddenly. And it's really, sometimes it's enjoyable for me, sometimes it's frustrating, to hear how sometimes that canceling, it's moving in and out of the meta, but we haven't talked about it. But it's obvious it is because of people's reactions to events, for example. One of the joys of design, but also the frustration of design, is, you know, we get something like that where someone talks about this interrupt is too strong, and then, you know, the next expansion comes out and another strong interrupt comes out, and everybody's reply is, well, you just cancel it. You know, there's all these cards that cancel it, so it's not really that strong. You know, but it was, but obviously more interrupt expansion canceling has come into the game since then. I don't know where I'm going with this, guys. I just thought it was a neat little thing that went out. Ah, stunning. This is where one of you guys segue to something neat or tell a neat story to back me up.
Well, that's all the time we have this week. No, I definitely... The amount of cancellation versus, you know, what's going on in the meta is always, you know, in flux. You couldn't throw a triple without hitting an event cancellation card in somebody's deck, you know, a year ago. And then I feel like this just the past couple of months, you know, it's been all events, all interrupts all the time. And people are having to swing their counter cards in a different direction. So, you know, things are always changing, and people just have to change with it.
Brad, are you thinking about going to Gen Con this year?
Yeah, I am. I actually thought about going to Worlds in Germany this last year, but there was another event that was happening on that weekend that I promised I would go to 3 years ago, so I kind of followed through with that instead, spent my money on that. But it's definitely something I've thought about. I mean, I've also thought that if I win the lotto, guys, I would actually probably travel every weekend to try to hit as many different tournaments as I could. I think that it would be great if there was someone out there that had the money and the time to go travel to different, just show up at, you know, random locals all over the place, you know, sneak in the back door of a local and people not realize that the person was there. And then, of course, tell the stories of what they saw. You know, I think that would be exciting for the game. But, so yes, I do have the plans to go to Gen Con, but man, I would have loved to have gone to the Grand Prix that just happened in Europe, and I would Mm-hmm. I would love to go play in every different Continental's Continental. I would, I mean, geez, every con I'd love to go, but I'd also love to show up for the local that maybe only has four players, or the local that brings in 10 players. I'd love to go to them all. Obviously, it's not possible, but I am thinking about, you know what, you probably asked me if I was going to Gen Con to move on to something else. I'm sorry. Yes, I am thinking about going to Gen Con this year.
No, I've recently made plans myself, so I'm looking forward to it, and I'm hoping this is going to be a big convention, and the more people go in, the more awesome it'll be. So excellent.
Oh, that's good. So I can bunk with you then, is what you're saying, right?
No.
Rogue, did you have a question?
I know. I was just going to say I could probably ask you random questions all night, but we don't want to, you know, run up your long distance intergalactic transmitting bill, your subspace long distance there.
Yeah, the doctor said that I could talk to anybody in space and time with it, but I worry what the bill is going to be. That's for sure.
We should wrap up, or that we are just out of intelligence for this particularly long transmission. So we're going to go ahead and write things off. On behalf of our producer TK, who is awesome and going to edit this into something interesting, and we are going to thank Warp 11, as Brad mentioned. They pretty much rock, and we'll look forward to hearing some more of them, both in our opening theme song and throughout the show. I am Sir Rogue.
And I am Sir Dan.
And I will thank once again Brad DeFruiter for stopping by and chatting with us, and remind the rest of you to expand your power in the universe.
And 92 is the number at the end.
Brad doesn't need to expand his power, because he's got plenty.
Help me, Spock. Help me, Spock.